Well, you've managed completely to intimidate a very smart audience, which is amazing, especially in Washington, where even dumb audiences you can't intimidate. Well, I have, yes. Please, introduce yourself.
My name is Emmett Stanky. I'm a first-year Japan Studies student here. My question has to do with the framing of Central Asia as an alternative for Japan and South Korea. It seems to me that at the end of the day, Russia and China have very concrete security interests that they can point to in Central Asia. China has the Xinjiang problem. Russia has, its old, the old Soviet republics that it still feels attachment to. And that for Japan and South Korea, there is no such draw. And I wonder if at the end of the day, more immediate geographic problems will simply just take precedence for South Korea and Japan. And the problem of Central Asia for South Korea and Japan will just be so far down the list that there is nothing to compete for.
So why is it going there?
Sure. How far can this go? That is the question.
Okay. Central Asia may seem far down, but Japan, two things, is in an energy crunch. They really need to diversify sources and find new stable supplies, not only of rare earth metals, as was pointed out, but also of gas and oil supplies and other natural resources that are getting harder and harder. With the loss of nuclear power, one of my slides showed that they have no more capacity for nuclear power, and may eventually get up to 22%. The share of fossil fuels imported by Japan at really high prices has gone up and up and up. So energy security is driving them to Central Asia. Second, there is a conscious effort on the part of the Abe administration to play big game politics and to score in Myanmar and kick the Chinese out, one big plus. They're doing wonderful. They're moving quickly in Iran. There's already, 2 days ago, signed a bilateral investment treaty, and the foreign minister came with 20 Japanese companies, not all risk-taking companies. That same kind of strategy, I think, is beginning to play in Central Asia. So Abe's visit, we just don't know what he's going to say, but I can extrapolate from other parts, is part of that game to gain not necessarily security influence, but still probably Russia is more in that ballpark, but to gain economic influence and have great relations with those countries. There's a tremendous amount of visitors going back and forth. There are all kinds of cultural exchanges. So building up good relations at many, many levels and then getting that kind of payback in terms of exports, exports,
and
exports.
And I would say from the Korean perspective, first of all, Korea shares exactly the same energy imperatives as Japan does. Almost identical, 99% energy dependent for foreign sources, for natural resources and so on. Although one thing, the additional pressure on Japan is because of the Fukushima, it's had to move away from nuclear, and South Korea is expanding nuclear. But it's beyond energy, because frankly speaking, they could go to Africa, they could go to other sources. You are right that in the short term, there may not be any direct and immediate security imperatives for either South Korea or Japan. But I don't think that's the point. I think, to be honest, it's sort of a very American way of thinking about it. There are short-term economic interests, and a lot of this is just commercial, right? But there are security implications if you think about the long term, and this gets down to the heart of the matter, which is the strategic rivalry for dominance in the future. And the real question, and this has very much to do with the U.S. role as well, because right now it's very clear that with China's strategy of One Belt, One Road, that China is eventually going to dominate. Now, whether or not they can dominate in terms of leadership politically and culturally, so normatively, that's a different question. There's no doubt that their physical presence through Central Asia will give them dominance. And the question is, and the problem, I think, the real pressing problem for Japan and South Korea in terms of security is, what follows China's economic engagement will also be security. And this One Belt, One Road, what's interesting is the road part is actually a maritime route. And the maritime route means that China will increasingly begin to control maritime routes. And that is a security concern for Japan itself.
If I could just add one word, warm water ports. Japan is really worried that warm water ports in that region will be controlled by China.
I think one more watch brings me back to the old days when Fred and I were about the other. But the point is also, you left out Central Asia. Central Asia is clearly a field on which others are trying to play. But the Central Asians are not just passive observers of their own fate. They want the connection to Japan and Korea. First of all, they benefit from the capabilities, which we understand, that Japan and South Korea has, which are indisputable. They benefit from the investment, the trade, the technology transfer, and they benefit from the political interest that those governments have, which is a counter to China and Russia's hegemonic aspirations, of which they have much better knowledge than we can. So they are an active player in this as well. And as I mentioned, India is also going to be in this game. The Indians are there too. We're not talking about India today, but they're in Central Asia too, and their stake will expand, and Modi wants it to expand.
He's just doesn't at all
understand. Now, if we had an enlightened American policy about Central Asia, we would be there in much stronger economic force as well. The point of this is a region that depends on the high investments. It's an equation with more than three unknowns.
When the Tokyo Donors Conference took place, there were discussions with the Japanese government that directly affect what we've heard today. The idea was, look, the Japanese were well aware of this, that 20 years down the road, India is going to have a much larger population, a much younger population. It will be part of a huge zone that includes Bangladesh and Pakistan, and that the transport routes through India, which are older than the Silk Road, the Chinese link, and longer and never interrupted, that these are coming back inevitably. And we never hear about it, but it's happening. Now, that raises an entirely different set of relationships in which both Korea and Japan participate, as well as India, as well as Australia. This is a pretty solid combination, and it then has its own land route that goes all the way, if you will, from Hanoi all the way to Europe, or will. My question is, does this prospect, does this linkage affect Central Asia or doesn't? And should it be calculated or are we only talking about leaping over North Korea in the case of Korea and in Japan, somehow leaping over China? It's a different grouping. Its individual members may not be the same size as China, but when you factor in India, they overwhelm it.
Well, furthermore, as I pointed out, we're dealing with an exceptionally dynamic situation. Let's take, for example, China. 6 months ago, everybody was saying, the Chinese are all over Central Asia, the Silk Road is coming, they're spending a ton of money, they're buying up all this or building the infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. This looks like it's a real process. If you go back and look at the literature that's just come out in the last 6 weeks or so, journalistic literature, scholarly literature, takes longer. It is not coming to the Chinese are encountering their problems. Why? Because you had a major economic crisis in the summer where they lost billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, in, at least on paper, in wealth. And they're poor people. That doesn't, I mean, the system's not falling apart. But they've got their problems. Second, the violence in Xinjiang has not gone away. It's not going to go away despite economic development. So China itself is, to some degree, an unknown. The question with Japan is, will Abe's grand strategic vision succeed? It's by no means certain that he will succeed. He has not really overcome Japan's structural economic problems, which are really drive capabilities. South Korea's Eurasian vision might be a great vision, but again, can it make it work? Russia's trajectory is also unknown, because now the country's in an economic crisis. So as I say, you cannot just sit there and say, this is going to happen logically, and we can just assume that it requires careful scrutiny of an incredibly dynamic process.
Quick question. Is there any Korean-Japanese cooperation in Central Asia?
Between Japan and Korea?
Yeah.
There's no cooperation about anything else, so no. Well, that's the easy answer. But just,
there is a consortium. There is a Korean-Japan in Central Asia.
I'm slightly dispute this idea that the Chinese economy will not be able to expand. In fact, aside from the stock market, in fact, investments in the Silk Road could actually be an answer and solution to Chinese economic problems. One of China's real economic problems is not this loss of capital in the stock market. That's really beside the point. It's really actually industrial overcapacity at the moment. And right now, the Chinese government needs an outlet for this, and actually developing the less developed, underdeveloped Western regions of China and into Central Asia is actually the perfect solution for this. They can pour all of those investments and direct them there. Secondly, your point about political instability, that's really important. But that also is partially behind Chinese strategy. Because, again, a lot of this unrest, the idea, whether this is correct or not, I don't know, but Chinese thinking from Beijing is, because these areas are so underdeveloped economically, and they've been so isolated from the rest of, Eastern China's industrialization, that actually pouring investment and lifting them economically, integrating them into the broader mainland Chinese economy, will actually supposedly tone down some of these political extremism. Now, I don't know if that's the solution, but that's
the solution. It's a classic Leninist nationality policy. Go back and look at the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s. The plan of Moscow.
It's also
the idea that if we overcome the industrial backwardness of Central Asia, massive investments, we will create a proletariat, it will be an international culture. Yes, it will have national elements and traditions and forms of culture, but the content of the culture will be socialist, and they will integrate with the Russians and so on. It did work, and it's not working in China because the unrest in Xinjiang continues. If anything, it grows because of that economic development, because as we have come to see, economic and political development and modernization breed nationalism.
Okay, we have in the room here today some very authoritative people from Afghanistan, and we haven't mentioned it. And a more modern definition of Central Asia would include it. I would like to ask all three of you very quickly, looking at it from both sides, how does Afghanistan figure in this picture? Increasingly, decreasingly, what's the story?
It's really hard to say because Japan treats Afghanistan very, very much differently than Central Asia. It's almost as if Afghanistan and the U.S.-Japan alliance go hand in hand. So almost everything that Japan has done with its huge ODA largesse and other aspects of supporting the war on terror, et cetera, have been at the United States. So it really does not, I think, have an agenda in Afghanistan that is beyond what it inherited, if you will, from the Bush administration.
And I would say that's equally true of South Korea as well. So much of it is dominated by the alliance and by U.S. security objectives in Afghanistan. And in fact, the way the South Korean governments have defined their Eurasia initiative is specifically by delineating these five countries, Central Asia, and Afghanistan is specifically not among that group.
Quick comment from some of our Afghans on Japan and Korea. Maybe so.
Introduce yourself. Well, also, I am visiting scholar with the National Science Exercise. Well, on Japan specifically, if you look at Japan's investment in Central Asia, especially in Turkmenistan, but more in Uzbekistan, Uzbekistan is trying to attract or work with Japan to expand the route to Persian Gulf and also Indian Ocean. So Japan, Uzbekistan worked with ADB, supported by Japan, to build Tehran Mazar-e-Sharif Railway, and to that they're trying to connect the corridor to have a route to the Indian Ocean. The same thing they want to connect with for example India through China, or now the alternative route. If TAPI does not work with Pakistan, there is another alternative going to the gas pipeline going to India through that, because India already invested so much to build the railroad connecting Chabahar all the way to Central Asia. So Japan actually ADB is involved in that. So I think there is also beyond the ODA and the strategic alliance with the United States, Japan investment to Central Asia. Central Asia's utilizing the ODA of Japan is to connect to Persian Gulf and also the Indian Ocean. I think that's something that's coming up.
That's the mic either there or behind you, either or both.
What he was saying also doesn't get as far as sites. Japan is one of the oldest friends of Afghanistan. We see Japan as a friend, one of the traditional donors, and one of the oldest diplomatic relations that we have was Japan. With South Korea, we have established recently, because South Korea's diplomacy was really diversified recently, especially after COICA establishment and some other activities they have done so far. But for South Korea is also involved in case of Afghanistan. But one thing which is really important is that does stability of Afghanistan really matter the relationship between South Korea, Japan, and the United States, and Central Asia? Or if I may put it in another way, that the stability of Afghanistan really correlates with the stability of Central Asia. And another observation that I have is that why we still keep talking and talking and talking Central Asia? Central Asia is consisting of five countries, five different countries. You know, there's a good race started so far among countries. Pakistan, India, China, and now Japan, they are visiting Central Asia. Either they have good policies in place, you know, in terms of like, I don't know how to call it, bilateral relationship or Central Asia particular country relationship, or they still need to know who are Central Asian countries. So this is something which we really need to consider while we are talking geoeconomics. Kyrgyzstan is very much different than Uzbekistan, and Uzbekistan policy is so much different than Turkmenistan. And there, if we talk about economics, Kazakhstan is in a new emerging economic in our region, which is sort of having the highest impact on not only on its southern countries, but on Russian and China as well. Remember, China announced their One Belt, One Road policy in Astana. You know, because that's now becoming a center of not only economics, but center of diplomacy in that region. But Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajik, so they're still not really, you know, in terms of how Kazakhstan is improving and emerging into the market economy, they're still lagging behind. But now again, I go back to Afghanistan and its relation, Afghanistan's relation with the Central Asia. It is really interesting. It will be interesting for me to understand what, how the future of this relationship will be seen from the U.S. and their relations, Japan and Central Asia policy. So for the policy.
Thank you. Pass the mic behind you, then.
Thank you very much. So this is a Japan.
Can you introduce?
Oh, sorry, Shai Rangarantsoa Fellowship in SAIS, from Afghanistan. So this discussion is Japan and Korea's country, obviously, but and the analysis was regarding the logic behind the race to Russia, Central Asia, and try to have a piece of the pie. And that was the focus of the discussion, and India was mentioned in passing. Now, Afghanistan right now is almost always seen through the exclusive lens of the alliance and security situation for Japan and Korea, but not for India. In the past 10, 13 years, India has heavily invested in potential linkages to Central Asia through Afghanistan, and the United States and ADB, through the Assistance and Financial Commission of Japan, we have seen two major initiatives kickstart and be implemented, one being CASA 1000, the other being TAFI, which has finally started its implementation phase. So I guess my question or comment would be that there are two scenarios. Scenario one is Afghanistan's security situation would not make it accessible or attractive to Korea and Japan, allowing India greater proximity and geographic access to Central Asia because it's their neighborhood. They have the linkages, the cultural proximity to Afghanistan. And so Japan and Korea would somewhat lose out. That's scenario one. Scenario two is if the security paradigm in Afghanistan change, and they become, Afghanistan becomes peaceful and it's more accessible to Korea and Japan, I think in that scenario, then you would have to add the sixth state of Afghanistan into your definition of Central Asia. Because otherwise, if you don't engage Afghanistan, India will have direct and predominant access to natural resources available in a variety of countries, making up Central Asia based on your definition. So hopefully we'll have scenario two in the near future. But I think it's a worthwhile intellectual exercise.
Thank you very much. I want two quick remarks. First of all, the problem with Afghanistan is that, as the Battle of Kunduz shows, Afghanistan is not yet able to stand on its own. It's at least seen from here now. The Allied military forces need to be there for some undefined length of time. I think they ought to provide stability. The overwhelming recognition by everyone, this includes Russia, is that Afghanistan is a very unstable place. Russia's actually think it's going to fail. I had an article coming out that says so, for RUSI, the United Services Institute. And if you look at their military moves, it shows that they're very concerned about this. So, Afghanistan is going to benefit from TAPI as that moves forward, CASA 1000. But other projects are going to be slow until and unless the war is brought to some sort of solution. The second point, to respond to your question, I remember a book from about
38, 40 years ago, I think you wrote an article, Fred, in that, Cyril Black and other people were talking about inner Asia, right? Instead of Central Asia. And that may make more sense, because it includes Xinjiang, lots of China, as well as India, and Pakistan, and Central Asia. And maybe Mongolia too. It's a long time
ago.
That might be a better term. The problem is that the United States has fallen into the habit of doing this. And my last point is, I was at a conference 32 years ago here in Vancouver, Kennan Institute. We spent 3 days discussing Stockerkreuz Trennealogy. What is Central Asia? And they couldn't come to a conclusion.
I'm sorry, we're running out of time, so I'd like
just a real quick point.
Yes, each of you, that the last word.
First, the comment about the AIIB projects. What I'd like to mention is that once the AIIB was established by China and the U.S. and Japan, which only the AIIB found out about it, they immediately boosted tremendously the financing, the funding of the AIIB so they could compete with China. Including Central Asia. Second point is that the kinds of companies that are going into Central Asia right now are the trading companies, the risk takers, and they build the infrastructure, they build the power plants, they build all of the foundation of the country. When that is complete, then the other companies selling, cars and computers and things like that start coming. And that's the investment phase of most Japanese firms.
Thank you, Bill.
My final point is just to address this issue about talking about this region. I think if you're in the region, I can certainly understand why you might resent being moved together with it. But for the same reason why there's Southeast Asia. And I think Southeast Asia is even worse. You're talking about a region that includes Laos and Cambodia, along with Australia and Singapore and Thailand. So, and talk about even more diverse in terms of, ethnicity and everything else. So I think, but the point is that from the perspective of, external regional neighbors, I think there is something to a regional approach and focus. For better or for worse, but it means better.
Yes, let me just conclude with one word. As Napoleon said, the country's geography determines its foreign policy.
No word more true than that.
Let me draw this together the following. First of all, I think there's general agreement among all three of you, this is a very dynamic time. That drawing conclusions on the basis of what existed 5 or 10 years ago is completely out of place. And Steve has used 3 times the word dynamism. I think that's a big message of today, that there are new levels of engagement in Japan and Korea. We have a gentleman from the Japanese embassy who follows Central Asia here today. That's evidence, I would say. But this is very important because, second point, it is clearly, in the case of Korea and Japan, there is increasingly an awareness of the security and strategic component. Whether it's how far it goes and what forms it takes is another question. But the idea that these are two countries that we don't do security, we don't do strategy, that what I've heard today is that isn't quite appropriate as we move forward. Things are evolving. Now, the third point I would make is that what we've heard today opens big prospects for the Central Asians themselves. As has been said, they're not passive. They're not just something acted upon. They're quite capable of identifying and pursuing their own interests, not just individually, but in sometimes even together. I think this, what I can draw from these really very, very substantive reports, is that the Central Asians do have the possibility of adding somehow and to some extent as does Afghanistan. Korea and Japan to their balancing, which they're all engaged. Final fourth point that I would make is that I think we have to be very careful not to underestimate the subtlety and tenacity with which Central Asians and Afghanistan are capable of pursuing their interests, and in other words, playing well the cards that they have. I just end with a simple note. We've talked about it as a kind of remote and strange place, and not developed the way Japan and Korea are, but in the 11th century, there lived a guy who was born in Kyrgyzstan, who was a Turkologist. And along with his other writings, he produced the oldest map of Japan. It wasn't produced in Japan, it was produced in Central Asia. And I should also note that if you go to Samarkand, you will find in the walls of what was once a palatial structure, you'll find a group of foreign businessmen lining up with gifts for the local ruler. And a very clever Korean scholar saw this, or saw a picture of it, and he noticed that the guy fourth in line in that row was Korean. now, in other words, we shouldn't think necessarily that we have a modern and pre-modern, and we have an active and a passive players in this script, but a much more complicated situation. And what I hope we all take from this today is that life has become more complex with the activation of Japan and Korea, and in directions which none of our three great experts were able to spell out for us, because life is uncertain. So thank you very much.
In 2000.